And of course, I also want to acknowledge the and thank the support and the long-standing partnership with the governments of the Netherlands and Sweden, and also the meaningful alliances that we have with other governments that are here in the room with us today, like Liechtenstein, Belgium, Canada, the US, Switzerland, and others. They all together make possible our work in countries like Syria and Colombia, in which we are going to focus the conversation today, but also in many others in the world over. Without their support, we wouldn't be able to work with our local partners, with victims groups, civil society organizations, and other partners to advance accountability processes to materialize the victims' rights to justice, truth, and reparation, and to work preventing the repetition of violence. In brief, to work towards building sustainable peace, inclusion, and development. Again, we are very, very grateful for your support. To formally start this event, and I hope the sound is working well, I want to offer the floor to His Excellency Ambassador Olivier Maes, the permanent representative of Luxembourg to the United Nations, to deliver his introductory remarks. Ambassador, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Travesi, for this introduction. Distinguished participants, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Olivier Maes. I'm the permanent representative of Luxembourg to the United Nations, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to this side event on ensuring the role of victims and families in search processes for the missing and disappeared in Syria, which is organized by the International Center for Transitional Justice in collaboration with the governments of Finland and Luxembourg. Let me thank you, Mr. Fernando Travesi, director of the ICTJ, dear Fernando, and your team for taking this very timely initiative. Indeed, today's discussion comes at a time when as many as 2 billion people, a quarter of humanity, live in conflict zones, and the world is facing the highest number of violent conflicts since World War II. With the increase in conflicts around the globe, the processes of tracing missing persons, including the need to address the plight of victims, the survivors, and their families, are increasingly coming to the fore, also at the United Nations. The Convention for the Protection of All Persons from Enforced Disappearance was adopted by the UN General Assembly in 2006, and it entered into force in 2010. It is the first universally binding treaty to define and prohibit the enforced disappearance as a human rights violation. And I'm pleased to share with you that Luxembourg, my country, also ratified this convention earlier this year. The convention has been signed by 98 states, ratified by 68 states, and it places an obligation on states to investigate acts of enforced disappearance and to bring those responsible to justice, along with preventive measures and respect for victims' rights. In countries such as Colombia, where Luxembourg has been a staunch supporter of the ICTJ's work, important efforts promoting investigations and support to survivors and families have been carried out under the integrated system of truth, justice, reparation, and non-repetition of the peace agreement. And I'm very happy that colleagues from Colombia are here with us today. So efforts have been made, progress has been made. Nevertheless, today, tens of thousands of forcibly disappeared persons are still unaccounted for around the world, leaving their relatives uncertain of their whereabouts. And that is particularly the case in Syria. More than a decade into the Syrian conflict, we can say that more than 100,000 people are missing or have forcibly disappeared, according to data that has been verified by Syrian civil society organizations. Some estimations put the figure of disappeared in Syria at more than 130,000. Their disappearance may be attributed to summary executions, to arbitrary detentions, abductions, combat operations, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Ladies and gentlemen, in last year in December, the UN General Assembly thus requested the Secretary General of the United Nations to conduct a study on how to bolster efforts to clarify the fate and the whereabouts of missing people in Syria, identify human remains, and provide support to their families. The recently shared report of the Secretary General calls, among others, for improving existing mechanisms and also for member states to consider establishing through the General Assembly a new international body, so an independent and internationally mandated mechanism for this purpose, to clarify the fate and whereabouts of missing people in Syria. This proposal has gained significant traction, and we very much welcome the report of the Secretary General, as the General Assembly here in New York is preparing to consider the situation of human rights in Syria. And against this background, today's event is indeed very timely. It will seek to discuss viable solutions and recommendations for the process in Syria while drawing on the views of various stakeholders. Particular emphasis will be placed on lessons learned from experiences in Colombia with a view to implementing a victim-centered and family-inclusive mechanism on the missing and disappeared in Syria. In closing, I would like to express our appreciation to all the panel participants and to all colleagues attending this event. And it now gives me great pleasure to hand the floor back to you, Fernando. It is really an honor for Luxembourg to co-host this event with you and with the government of Finland, and we look forward to a very fruitful discussion. Thank you. Gracias. Shukran. Shukran.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. We are going to continue with our agenda. I need to excuse Her Excellency Ambassador Elina Kaliku from the Permanent Representative of Finland, who is arriving. Please, Ambassador, we had started, but I'm going to ask the panelists, please, to come to the podium while we Gloria, Luz Marina, Amina, if you want to sit. So we were about to actually Her Excellency the Ambassador from the Permanent from Finland to the United Nations was about to speak. I was about to announce that we were continuing because of a misunderstanding on the timing. Great timing, Ambassador. Thank you very much for joining. I hope you don't feel uncomfortable just taking the podium to make your comments right on the time. I hope you feel okay, and thank you for being with us. I just wanted to thank you personally and your government for the support to ICTJ. Please, the podium is yours.
Thank you so much, and I think this tells a little bit about our timing challenges approaching next week. not everything quite on time, clearly. But I wanted to say a few words that I was clearly supposed to say half an hour ago. I would also like to join Ambassador Olivier of Luxembourg, who welcomed you already to this event. First of all, I would like to reaffirm Finland's steadfast commitment to end impunity for atrocity crimes, wherever they occur, of course. Much attention has lately been focused on Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine, against norms of international law and the United Nations Charter. But I want to underline that this must not lessen our commitment to ensure accountability in Syria or in any other country where systematic violations of human rights occur. Before our great panelists take the floor today, I would like to offer three reflections on the topic we're discussing today. The first one is the seriousness, but also the incomprehensible scale we are talking about in Syria. Estimates recently cited by the United Nations indicate that more than a staggering 100,000, even up to 130,000 persons are missing as a result of the ongoing conflict. They all have family members and loved ones who are wondering about the fate of the missing and being doomed to uncertainty marked by hope and fear. There are good reasons why the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Syrian Arab Republic, mandated by the Human Rights Council, recommended establishing a dedicated international mechanism for this tragedy. The missing and the disappeared have been central in the ongoing work of the IIIM, which Finland has supported financially since the very beginning. The second issue I wanted to mention is about the role of victims and families. We need to put victims and their families at the heart of international criminal justice. They deserve to be heard, to be involved, and ultimately to see justice done. Victims also deserve assistance and reparations. Finland has supported the ICC Trust Fund for Victims since its establishment, and I certainly encourage other countries to support this important fund too. I would like to add that female family members are subject to manifold vulnerabilities. For instance, the traditional gender roles prevalent in Syria cause women to be more likely to suffer from poverty and isolation. The third and last issue I wish to raise is the role of the civil society and non-governmental actors in documenting serious violations of international law. We are proud to support the important work of the ICTJ, including in Syria and also Colombia, where ICTJ's support for grassroots initiatives and the voices of women and persons in vulnerable positions is so important. I would like to finally commend the work of all those involved in search processes of the missing and disappeared in Syria and in the work for their families. This is going to be an important discussion today. Thank you very much, and also on my behalf, warmly welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For being with us. Can you hear me well? Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to start with a conversation. The setup of this room is not casual. We've decided to do a different setup, not to make a very strict formal round of panel speakers, but more a conversation and a collective brainstorming, also with questions and answers from people from the room on this very particular issue and this very sensitive issue. We've heard already, and most of you might be familiar with the report that has been mentioned. Maybe you have read it. or you've contributed to the elaboration of that report. Let me say just at the very beginning that this is a very thoughtful and comprehensive report, and I think includes a number of actionable recommendations in order to booster the efforts to clarify the fate and the whereabouts of the missing and the disappeared. Recommendations to the Syrian government, recommendations to other parties of the conflict, recommendations to member states and the international community, and also international and national organizations and victims groups. One of them, perhaps catalyzing most of the recommendations, is the General Assembly to consider the creation of a new mechanism, international mechanism, to clarify the fate and the whereabouts of the missing in Syria. Before going into the report, I want to say that this is a benchmark, and I want to acknowledge the importance of this report and this consideration in the fight for justice in the Syrian conflict. It's a significant achievement, in our view, represented in that report, an achievement of the Syrian Families Associations, of the victims groups on Syria, an achievement of those who have been documenting and advocating for justice in Syria since 2011, and of course, including the Truth and Justice Charter. It's also an achievement for the UN system as itself. It's an achievement of the International Commission of Inquiry and also the Office of the Human Rights and the Secretary General's Office coming with this very thoughtful report. It's an achievement, I believe, also for all of us, international organizations like ICTJ, who have been working for years on this very difficult conflict issue and very sensitive and painful. And I think we all need to acknowledge the importance of the moment of this report. So this gathering today, this side event, tries to make a collective reflection. The report is just came out, and it's going to be part of the discussions in the future weeks or months. And we want to reflect a little bit on what could it be, an international mechanism with this mandate? How could it operate? What could it be done, and what the obstacles would be? We really want to advance that discussion around critical questions and also thinking about what the role of the Syrian families or the organizations might have in the establishment and the operations of such humanitarian mechanism, or how that mechanism could implement the mandate in a context where we know the Syrian government is not showing collaboration, in a context where they might have not access to the ground. What else can be done meanwhile? And that's why we have here a very impressive and important panel of guest speakers. We will hear from two Syrians who have been working tirelessly to advance the cause of the missing people and forcibly disappeared and detainees in Syria since 2011, and who can offer very important insights into how families and organizations can support and collaborate with this new institution. You have the bios attached to the agenda, so I'm not going to go through it just to focus on the conversation. I would only say that Amina Kolani is the founding member of the Families for Freedom, and we will hear more about that. And Ibrahim Olavi is a barrister at Guernica 37 and the chair of the Syrian Legal Development Program. I want to add that we in ICTJ, as an institution, we know well that this context all are unique, and the processes need to be tailored to the context, responding to the context, and based in opportunities and capacities on every country, and they are always different. However, as an organization, we are also convinced that there is a very enormous potential and a very big added value on facilitating exchange of knowledge and cross-exchanging experiences. And I think that comparison, even if it cannot be done automatically, it can be inspiring or learning for lessons from other countries. And that is the reason why we thought the very long experience of Colombia in the search of the missing for the more than 50-year-long conflict could be an added value to this conversation. And that is why, if the contexts are different, even if the contexts are different, the objectives are the same. And we are honored as well to have with us today Luz Marina Monzón. She is the director of the Unit for the Search of the Missing in Colombia. And also dear Gloria Gómez, who is also an activist and the leader of and founder of the first association of families in Colombia for the search of the disappeared, called ASFADES by its name on Spanish. And they will provide insights into this conversation from the Colombian perspective and experience. So you have the agenda. We're going to start with the conversation. We will open for questions and answers from the floor. And I also encourage everybody to ask and bring up your comments or questions. And we want to close the event showing something that we've produced based on the report I was mentioning before, a very short animation film that shows the experiences of the Syrian families searching for their loved ones. Without further, thank you for waiting, and thank you for being here. The four of you have been traveling and arrived just for this event, and we appreciate very much. It's an honor for us to have you individually, and even more as a group, to have the conversation that we are going to have today. I'm going to start asking a few questions. Please feel free, address to each of you, but feel free to comment or react if you feel you have something to say. And I wanted to start with you, Amina. Welcome. Thank you very much. Amina, you know very well, and we all know, that the Syrian conflict, the number of violations of humanitarian law and human rights violations in the Syrian conflict are uncountable. And the amount of information is overwhelming. It's been said many, many times that there are so much information, that there are so much evidence that are even impossible to manage. And we've heard and we've read in this report that that information, now talking about the disappeared, the detainees, or the forcibly disappeared, or the missing, that information is dispersed among different databases of different organizations or different institutions. And we also know that organizations sometimes have resistance to share information and to collaborate with each other because of the risk they've taken into collecting that information. I want to ask you, based on your experience, Amina, considering the risk, the experience, the work that you have done, how do you think organizations can work together and can really collaborate together towards creating such common mechanism or such common instrument for the search of the missing in Syria?
Thank you, Fernando, and thanks everybody. And thank you for all who are present here. Maybe I would like to share some of the feelings I had while reading the report, and this will be in my remarks also. When I read the report, it reminded me that 11 years ago in Syria, I left, I went out with my brother, Majed, and we were men, women, wonderful men and women. We were asking for some rights, freedom, just maybe there are obvious things, and people here may not think about claiming these rights. And what happened is that three of my brothers were detained, and I was detained with my husband. After some years, I left, and my husband was freed after 2.5 years. So, and then we were asking for the freedom of the remained people who remained in jail. And we went on, and after a few years, we were asking for the remains. I do not know if you are able to imagine the pain and the feeling of injustice as a survivor of the jail, my siblings, my parents, tens of thousands of families in Syria, the sense of frustration on our path to freedom, and that has a lot of passion and a lot of blood. Regardless, we are still continuing in our struggle, and today, 6 years ago, I founded with other Syrian women, families of the disappeared, and it is the first movement in Syria who is led by the families of the disappeared, and that was in 2013, and we continue. After some time, we realized there are other connections between the families. So we went and we called all the families to speak in one voice in front of the international community, because nobody was hearing us before. After that, we had this charter for freedom, and then we had the study for the mechanism. And when I was reading, I was choking when I was reading the report and the plane. And with that, there are countries and there are people in the international community. They need to be convinced for the necessity of this mechanism. Even though this mechanism has been studied for years and years to get the report of the Secretary General, and now we need a year, if it's been voted for, and then another year to be an actual body to actually work. So the path is very, very long, and we are looking for remains. This is remarkably painful. And I would like you to feel the frustration, the pain as family, as Syrians. We need to convince the countries of the world to have a mechanism to find the remains or see if our relatives are alive. I'm sorry about my frustration. This is just not my feeling. This is the feeling of all the families and the relatives. Of course, we will talk about technical issues, but it's very important for me to share with you what we leave. This is just 1% of the cases. That's why we are really grateful for all the governments from around the world and the people. And I always call for more support, and that they would try and pressure other countries who are maybe still doubting or they don't want to. What is the point of having, not having a mechanism such as this one? So I'll go back to your question, Fernando, and I'm sorry that I went on. In this context, the mechanism, what we see, it will be the center or the place that tens of thousands of family will go to, that will give them perhaps some hope. That would be the reference to document the violation or to have any news of their families, because there are tens of organizations worked on documentation, others worked on with the victims. We have a lot of documentation, but this documentation is spread out. It needs to be in one database, and that would give perhaps some trust for the families that they would be more forthcoming in dealing with it. And some families may fear if this may lead to their detention or something like that, because some people do not imagine if I were, if I had a disappeared husband or brother, or I cannot be asking about the detention center, because this would be a reason for my own detention. So that there is one organization that is sponsored by the United Nations that gives a sense of trust for the family. That's what we thought about, to have an independent international mechanism that deal with our cause. Of course, this is the most painful thing in Syria. Maybe I'm right to say that there's not one family in Syria who is not hurt by this, whether they are supporter of the regime or not. Of course, the regime is the main violator of rules, but there are other parties. Everybody needs to know what happened to these people. And the support from the international community is very important. It's not enough, but it is the first important step. Thank you very much.
Interesting what you're saying, that the report is very good, saying that there is no assistance for the Syrian families to go for the search of the disappearance. They are by themselves. They are left alone. And you're saying they expose themselves to risks and to different types of... they become very vulnerable to get arrested, but also to be blackmailed, and also different exposure. And these... mechanism that you were saying, and we were hearing, is an estimation of 120,000 people multiplied by all the members of their family, of people in extreme vulnerability only for the search. Can you share a little bit with us of what are those risks that the families, when they are out of Syria or in Syria, what are their experiences when they are alone by themselves trying to search their beloved ones, trying to get some information? What is the lack of a system looks like for you and the families like you who are constantly searching for your family members?
Thank you.
The truth is that the challenges and the dangers are really many. Too many to count, and I'm delighted that it was mentioned in the report. And to be objective, that the report was very comprehensive, and it has all the standards for this mechanism. These are very, very useful points. But I'm sorry, I started speaking from the heart. The challenges, first, as a woman where you don't have a male supporter, that's already most of the disappeared are male, so the women are out there looking for them. So women who are looking for the first, they are exposed to be detained, could be harassed, could be subject to sexual violence, and also there is a black market, so we have to pay money to get one detainee out. I'm sorry if I am to share my story. So when we went to the prison where my brother in Sadnaya, I had to pay a bribe, but I had to do that to see my brothers, and I saw them like skeletons walking. There is no official way for me to visit with them. Even when my husband left the detention center in the section of Jawiya, he left also with a bribe. We had to pay, We paid thousands of dollars to get him out. This is a black market. So the families need to pay to get the lives of their relatives. We tried with our remaining my brothers. Only one brother it worked, but three other brothers did not work. So thousands of Syrian women do face that. The other challenge, so the laws, the family laws, as a woman, you don't have parental rights for you. So I am not the legal guardian of my children. Like, I am an academic. I speak to the United Nations, but I don't have the parental authority to get them out of the country. This is another challenge that Syrian women do face, on top of all the pressures, psychological and other, plus all the fears. Many Syrians, they don't want to document the disappearance of their relatives or to make an official report, because this will expose them to detention. So when I went to Lebanon, even within Lebanon, there is also a limit to my freedom in looking for my relatives. If I were still living in Lebanon, I would not have been able to the Security Council. Now that I live outside, I can. This is, and also in the neighboring countries. And on top of that, the education of the children, there is an important challenge for the families. If there's a deceased son, or they could have a death certificate, they could deal with inheritance or deal with the kids. But if they are detained, there is no documentation, so there is nothing. So you have nothing. You are outside of time, outside of place. So the wife or the mother of the detainee, it is a condition. That's why a lot of official parties ask for documents. But there is not. So there is nothing to prove that my husband was detained. So the challenges are way too many for the families. That's why we need a new mechanism. That's what we want. Thanks again to the Secretary General on his report. He spoke about the mission of the mechanism in two parts. First is to finding what the fate of these people and to give back the remains. And the second point is the support, extensive support for the family of the survivors, whether it's economic, social, or psychological. And there are a lot of details. And he spoke about maybe other countries can issue official documents for the children. All such things, we mentioned them in our study. I will bring it up when we answer the questions, but this is it for now.
Shukran jazilan.
We're going to come back to that, and your experience is illustrative of so many victims in Syria and other countries. I see Luz Marina Monzon from Colombia nodding and saying yes, yes, when she's listening to Amina. And I want to ask you something, Luz. You have been mandated to create a unit for the search of the missing in Colombia, which is the result of the peace agreement between the Colombian government and the FARC. And we could speak for hours about the operational, logistic, and staffing problems and challenges you had to overcome in order to create the unit that is fully functioning today. But I want to focus on how you conceptualized the unit in relations with the victims and the families of the disappeared. How did you establish those bridges, and how did you open the space, or how did you count with them to collaborate from the inception of the unit and to the work that you are doing today?
Bueno, buenas tardes a todos. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much, Fernando and Alicia, for the invitation. It is very special. Thank you to the ambassadors and all the assistants. It is an honor and a pleasure to be here exchanging ideas regarding a very important initiative for a multilateral organization as the United Nations, whose object is peace. Peace is a human right. We cannot address this without supporting those that have disappeared and their families that are looking for ways to find their loved ones. The unit of search had a great opportunity to handle a work that had never been done in a systematic approach, in an advanced approach in our country, even though there had been more than 5 decades of reports of people that had disappeared during armed conflict. The unit is established based on the experience of family members that even though such entity did not exist, families were in search of it. Just like Amina says, throughout all these years, families have been knocking on doors. They have been asking for obstacles to be overcome. And one of the obstacles was data, which was dispersed, which was not organized, which was not accessible, and that prevents search. Because I believe that there's something that we learn when we are engaging in this task is that information is vital. Without information, there's no way to find the disappeared persons. And that is what this unit has had the opportunity to establish itself with a view to centralize information, organizing it, updating it, and then also trying to have all that data from different state organizations and institutions. So the unit is able to receive official and non-official information in order to be able to start the search of disappeared persons. Colombia, just like Syria, but it's been in a longer period of time though, does have a similar number of disappeared persons, over 100,000 disappeared persons during the armed conflict, which means this is a great challenge because we're able to talk about masses. When we're talking about masses and the tenure of a period of disappearance, then you have to start a search with the same logic in mind, a logic of masses, of connecting the patterns of disappearance and start a search of the information on that basis and have different sources of information that help you trace the possible location of the disappeared persons, where they might have been taken, and what the methods of camouflaging the access. So this has been a great challenge to consolidate and have access to the information, but cooperation has been crucial. Without cooperation, there is absolutely no way to do the work. And I would like to put cooperation in two dimensions. It has to be an institutional cooperation from all state institutions, but in situations as we are hearing of individuals that have had to leave their country, and as they were leaving the country, they have been disappeared or that we don't know their fate, then this creates the need for states to cooperate with one another to trace these migrations. And then also the other face of this, as the ambassador was saying, is that the victims may be able to be engaged in cooperation. So this mechanism, which I am mentioning and which is potentially created, cannot happen without the cooperation of the victims, because the mechanism can do many things, but there are other things that depend on what the victims can do and support to the victims. So this is an essential coordinated work in order to be able to move forth such a great challenge, such as alleviating the suffering by assisting them in finding out where the disappeared loved ones have ended up.
Question on that. So you're saying a mechanism that is created without the participation of the victims is basically set for failure. I'm hearing that if there is not even an option, is that if it doesn't come from the collaboration and the information from the victims, it's set for failure. What other ways the victims, in your experience, in your strategies, or classifying the information, what other ways the families and the victims have participated with you beyond giving you the information, on the thinking process, on the search, how they've participated concretely?
In many ways. And I would like just to back up a little bit, if you'd allow me. This is a parallel mechanism, but independent to legal processes, which is very important to me. Why? Because the search in general has been subordinated to criminal charges. And if it's subordinated to potential legal criminal charges, then it is not in the victims are not in the center of it all. It is only those that are being investigated that are in the center of it. So a mechanism, an independent mechanism, but that is related to criminal investigation, then can facilitate that the victims be in the middle of it. And in the middle of it, in the center of it, as the inform mentions, which this criticism of the relationship with the state that is only unilateral, that is only asking the family members for information, but that it does not really put them at the center of it, when in fact the family members have accumulated great experience. They know where the sources are. They know what is crucial in the search. And I would like to mention the following. The search is crucially a humanitarian measure, essentially humanitarian search. It is a humanitarian task, but with the responsibility of reparation by the state. So when victims are supported, essentially the victims are being repaired in their suffering. So you cannot carry on a search that excludes the victims of the search. So I think that it is very important to think in the following. When we are thinking about the involvement of the victims in the search, we kind of start to theorize many things, but on very few occasions we value the need. What are the individual needs of family members in a search? So these needs are built based on the experience they have faced. It is different to have a victim, just as Amina was saying, that might have gone through arbitrary detentions, tortures, family members that have disappeared, families that had to leave their country, to a victim that perhaps has not received any support, and it is an absolute detention that has not had the strength or a voice. The needs are different. So to be able to ensure their participation in a humanitarian process means that all those experiences and that knowledge have to be taken into account, and that is a great challenge. Very important challenge in order to make it efficient as a mechanism. Why? And I'll close. Because the international independent mechanism will then have a task, a responsibility, but also a limit, which is that it will be able to mobilize many things, but it will only be able to offer repair if it counts on the victims, if they work with the victims. And that is what we are doing.
Your experience doing a similar work in Colombia, and very meaningful. Thank you for that, Luz Marina. And you've opened a topic that I want to follow up with Ibrahim on distinguishing those two aspects of the search for the disappeared or for the missing. The criminal prosecution and focusing on the perpetrator and the crime, and the humanitarian side as a justice reparative measure of trying to bring some clarity on the fate and the whereabouts. Ibrahim, you've been litigating and working on this for years, and you are a lawyer. How do you manage that separation? How do you explain or articulate that separation to foster the coexistence of the two mechanisms without obstacling each other?
Thank you very much. When I used to work on, and still do work on accountability, I used to see it as a difficult task dealing with the amount of crimes that were committed in Syria as outlined by the report. But then when I talked to the families and seen the pain that they have, I started thinking, what sort of pain would lead someone to drop accountability from the table for all the suffering that they've went through in order just to know where the body of a loved one dies? The challenge that we are facing, that accountability, as important as it is backward looking. It's important for deterrence. It's important so that we don't see these crimes committed again. In November, I spoke at the Security Council, and I made the point to a number of states that it's not about Syria, it's about your next conflict. And in a few months, we knew which conflict happened. I just came from Berlin to this event. I was at an event in Berlin talking with Ukrainians. And Syria was mentioned 23 times by Ukrainians as an example of why Russia was able to do what it does, because we failed on kind of creating accountability for it there. And yes, it's important, because prior to coming to this event this morning, when the two ladies were introducing themselves, and Gloria has two siblings that are missing, and Amna has three, and they went and hugged each other, and the entire room broke out in tears. Accountability is key so that Amna is not hugging a Ukrainian mother in a couple of years, 10 years later, to say, sorry, we've been pushing for so amount of years, but the world let that happen again and again. So that's why accountability is kind of key in this. But all of that is still backward looking and not dealing with a pain that is ongoing. A pain of not knowing where your loved ones are, where you take risks in just asking about them, as Amina said. Everyone in this room has a loved one. If you would message them at this beginning of this event and they don't respond by the end of it, you would worry. You wait for 5-10 hours, you'd probably call the police, check on them, see what's happening. Now imagine that you cannot go to the police because the police will arrest you. And imagine this goes on for 10 years where you don't know how to close even the chapter. Should you wait for them for dinner? Should you make their bed? Should you put their picture down? Should you delete them from the family WhatsApp group? These are things that we feel every single day. And as much as it hurts, and I'm a lawyer and I'm used to courts and I'm used to accountability, the issues, there are different forums for these issues. And if the families are saying, just to reduce our pain for a little bit of knowing just where the bodies, the remnants lie, we're happy to put accountability for this mechanism on the side, you can only imagine the pain that they're going through.
Thank you, Ibrahim. I'm moved by your words. I want to follow up on what you're saying. There are different forms of bringing accountability, and I think it's an interesting thought to, you know, go a little bit deeper down. If those forms of accountability are coexisting, right? If families are focusing on the search or their loved ones and putting on the backseat, not renouncing, but putting on the backseat, identifying perpetrators and putting perpetrators in jail in case if it's possible, I wonder why we have to choose one or the other and we cannot work on both of them at the same time, considering the opportunities, I wonder. But you know well that victims are tired. There's been 11 years, how do you manage the expectations? How do you, and they don't trust anymore on events, on promises, or on the promise of a mechanism that might not be approved or might not be created. How do you manage their expectations and their trust on the idea of justice and the alliances that we try to support them.
I think the families and the victims who have been in search for their loved ones for so long have learned to adapt to manage their own expectations. We've been dealing with the international community, with the perpetrators for so long. I want to point you to a specific section that I was reading in the Secretary General's report about expectations. Many families are begging to know that their loved one is dead. You wish to know that they're dead because they're no longer suffering torture. They're gone, you can end the chapter. And so at some point, a couple of years ago, the Syrian regime started issuing death certificates. And that, as hurtful as it, citing the cause of death as a health reason. Families went and got these death certificates. Chapter closed. There is no burial site, there is no graveyard, you don't have a place to visit, you don't know where they are. But chapter closed. A few months ago, the regime released a few people, some of whom were issued death certificates and were said to be dead. What sort of expectation management after you felt, for all of those who knew that this has ended and it has given them this 1% of hope, hope that they don't want to have, that their loved ones might be alive or we don't know what's happening to them. So I think the expectation management is key, but I think a lot of the families have been able to know that this is more about the process. We're trying to push to do everything we can. That states should know that no family member around this table, or if you sponsor the resolution or push for it, would expect you to 100% be able to find their loved ones. But it's the thought and the process that counts. And we will remember it. I'm looking around this room and I recognize many faces. We remember Liechtenstein and Qatar for the IIIM. We remember the UK for sponsoring a lot of the resolutions at the Human Rights Council. We remember the French for their accountability against the use of chemical weapons. We remember the US on many of the kind of cross-border resolutions that they pushed for. We will remember Finland and Luxembourg for the work that they're doing. We remember the names. So even if you're pushing for a legacy, for something to tell your friends and your children that you managed to do something, no one is expecting you to change the world. And no one is expecting you to find the 130,000 that both ambassadors mentioned today. But it's the process, it's the idea that we have allies in this room and elsewhere who are working for it that made Amna and the other families sit in front of you here today, go through the re-traumatization because they believe that we have allies that can make things happen so that we don't end up in a conflict that affects your loved ones. God forbid. We never want to be on a panel and say, we've told you so. I struggled with the Ukrainians to say that. I wanted to, but I held back. And so don't do it just for us. Do it for the countries that you're worried about, for your loved ones that might be subjected to the same thing. Do it for a norm. You know, I was, when preparing Fernando for this, I was saying that we should help establish a norm about, you know, standing up against impunity. But we're talking about enforced disappearance here. When we talk about chemical weapons, you're not fighting to establish a norm. You're fighting the erosion of a norm that you have established for so many years. Through the issue of disinformation and denial and the recommitting of these crimes. So don't worry about managing our expectations, but let us work together in at least starting the process towards hopefully what would be a positive outcome.
Thank you, Ibrahim. Very powerful comments, and I believe that we are back on a moment of a political opportunity to do something concrete that might be meaningful for the future instead of just missing the train. I wanna turn back the conversation to the victim's experience. I'm gonna ask you, Gloria, Gloria, you have such a long experience as you've been working for decades on the search of the missing based on your own experience. This report brings up in a very clear and articulated way, and we've heard from Amina, the need of an institution that can offer adequate support to victims and survivors and the families, to provide that support to victims as part of the search. In your experience, in your work, in a life dedicated to this, unfortunately, but it's been your life, what does that support is about. How an institution can support the victims. How can you explain that support in concrete terms? What is that for you, in your experience?
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a true honor, and I would like to acknowledge ICTJ for this meeting that allows to have two countries together, but also to have Amina. It was great meeting you and strengthen our bonds for our disappeared loved ones. And also, Ambassador, I'd like to thank you for your support. And for these countries that go through this ordeal of disappearance, and also thanks to the fight of disappeared and missing people relatives, we, of course, expect for this support to be institutional, also from the international community. Of course, it's to be listened, to be heard, but also to support this need of searching for our loved ones, this need to know as well. Those answers that start coming up from the very moment that they are disappeared, that they take them. Of course, a family member of a disappeared person wants to be heard about what this person is experiencing, the anguish, the uncertainty, not knowing of what happened, just like in Syria and in the Colombians and their relatives in Colombia. We had to experience this for more than 40 years. My organization, as Fernando was mentioning, is the very first organization of relatives. 40 years ago, we started looking for answers as a result of the disappearance of our loved ones. And we always find from the institutions blindness and no response before the claim to our question of where they were. And please stop me if I go too long. But 40 years looking for an answer to be heard, hoping to be found, to have them back to us, and we were yelling on the streets, please bring them back to us, waiting for their return. We believe that this process of no support to understand the drama, the pain of a family when one or more loved ones are taken away is very difficult. The impact, the harm within the family, the emotional harm, of course, we're never going to get over that. But I believe that the support that an institution needs to have, first of all, is to listen, but also to act. And that's why in Colombia, in spite of the fact that the relatives are pushing forward, because we thought that locating the perpetrators or the abductors, they were going to tell us where they were and they were going to return them to us. That's why during the first years, we emphasized, as family members, we gathered to identify this fight in the pain, but also a need as a right to demand their presence, and a right that time served as well. To search for them is a right. The search is part of the truth and justice. One cannot coexist without the other one. So during the first years in Colombia, we fought to have legal tools. And finally, the political constitution of our country, as a result of the fight of Asfada's relatives, we had Article 12 of the express definition of disappearances and the practice of inhumane and degrading treatments, and nothing ever happened. They continued to disappear. in the midst of the persecution, of pointing out people, of murders and disappearances of those who were searching. My brother is the first victim because he was looking for the disappeared. That's why we began understanding that waiting to have tools such as Article 12 and the laws that acknowledged it as a crime, recognized it as a crime, and another set of legal tools did not give rise to the result of searching them. Today, we are aware of the fact that when we started as a result of the lack of response from the institutions because they were not searching for them, to be able to get to the negotiation table with the FARC guerrilla and the government of Colombia, that gave us the possibility to demand a body or a mechanism that was exclusively focused on search, truth as well. Even though we think and we keep insisting on the fact that justice is a right and needs to go hand in hand, of course, with the truth, but also, especially and above all, the search and the finding of the missing and disappeared people. It's not just searching, it's finding them. That's why I believe that we were finally heard, and the institutions nowadays, at least in Colombia, as a result of this fight, an uneven fight among relatives that came from a situation of pain, of anguish, but we became resilient. We had to learn. We became leaders because Amina, rightfully so, said that the search for disappeared people, it's always led by women because the men are the ones who disappear. Although in Colombia, there's a high percentage of disappeared women claiming the right of women, but also for supporting the fight of disappeared people. Therefore, this mechanism that we demanded in the Havana to be an exclusive mechanism, but a mechanism that could mitigate pain. And the only way to mitigate pain, as our colleague, the lawyer, was pointing out, Luz Marina mentioned it, to mitigate the pain means to find them, even if it's just their bodies or bones, helps to mitigate pain. Of course, pain will never disappear, but the need for an answer has always accompanied us and will accompany us until we are able to find the truth. It's a need also to mitigate that pain. I think that that's the way of achieving support, to be heard, to be able to be heard in this amount of things that occur to us every day.
In English, and you've mentioned very important points, like the search as a right by itself, as a way of starting bringing some justice. Not, of course, the result and the finding, it's important, but the search as mitigating the pain and the suffering of the victims. I want to ask you, and also ask Luz Marina before coming back to Syria, on something concrete. You, Gloria, founded an organization that today they have chapters all over the country. You have regional people all over the country. You, Luz Marina, have done search and plans to look around the country in areas where you don't have access or they are still under violence, or how you both have collaborated together to create those searching plans. How you, Gloria, has collaborated with a unit, with a new institution, to collaborate into that search, concretely with the people you with the members of the organization in the field.
I believe that having gone to Havana to ask that the unit for Serge be created, we can say that she is our daughter, even though it's part of the state. It is a daughter of the fight by family members and the demand by family members to create the mechanism. So what we're doing is we're gathering wills. We were very active from the moment that the negotiation table accepted Report 62, where they were mandating measures of trust, but also certain demonstrations of will. And we have gathered some recommendations for the unit to come forth and be able to consolidate itself as this mechanism to search for the disappeared persons. We have this exercise and the experience of 40 years of documentation. And I believe that in having been involved in the creation of the National Registry of Disappeared Persons, which unfortunately has not been completely consolidated due to the lack of political will of those that manage the registry, but we are committed, we have gathered our wills to go to different territories and gather not just information and consolidate it, consolidating information that is already in existence, but we believe that a great task is for family members to be actively involved in the search as this indicates. This is important, that the victims be in the center of every search process. We have brought forth for the strengthening of the unit these lessons learned, because who's going to build the search if not the family members? So we are greatly committed in consolidating what Luz Marina had mentioned, consolidating gathering of information. We have worked hard in reviewing a file of 40 years to be able to consolidate cases, contexts. Colombia is a multicultural country with great complexities, and there are areas where conflict is still a reality. We have supported, and we have been in territories such as Yoruba, which continues to be a territory in great conflict, in Cauca. And we have always said that we, the family members, have a legitimate right, even though we ourselves have been facing threats, disappearances. We have gone to different territories to support the processes and motivate the family members to organize themselves so that they can be support on territories for the unit.
One, before I want to get your reactions, Luz Marina, because I hear in that it's not only the families have provided the information, you have sat down together to analyze the information and to build the cases. Is my understanding correct?
Sí.
Yes. That is what's happened. I would like to say the following. As Gloria has explained, it's been 40 years of continuous requests to the state for a search of the disappeared persons, asking them to acknowledge that there are forced disappearances in Colombia. These are 40 years of experience, of great suffering as well, but also of great experience, of knowledge. So what has the unit done? We have supported each other with the knowledge and experience in order to be able to build the institution. When an institution like this is created, the family is not just starting out. They have been in the process for a long time. So what a mechanism like this must do is to walk the path hand by hand of that knowledge and experience as to not to delay an answer, because a humanitarian mechanism must be expedient, must be as expedient as possible with a view to mitigate suffering. So what have we done with organizations and victims? Organizations have, for a long time in many parts of the country, have carried out technical work, but also great solidarity. This work generates trust within a context where there is no trust. An institution is not able to find this by itself. So to be able to work with organizations and the trust that family members have in them is a sort of support that the report says very accurately is to prevent causing more harm to the family members, not to have them retell the story of pain time and time again. The organizations have already worked with the victims, so the idea is to be able to do this with the organizations in order to expedite the process without causing the victims more harm. But another very important factor is that those who know this specificity of the needs, of the expectation, the expectations is very important, especially in the process of search. Why? Because one can say, so what is the expectation in a search? For them to be found, but it goes beyond that. It's for them to confirm if what they told me, that they were released from jail, if that's true. That's an expectation. Second, where were they taken? That's another expectation. What are they doing with the information I delivered? That's another expectation. This has to be discussed. It must be discussed in the process in order for the process to be to provide repair and to make sense. And this is what we are doing. This is what we are building, especially with the focus on differences on ethnicity, gender, which has been very important in the impact of disappearances in our country, which has also been built hand in hand with the organizations. And I believe that this is an advantage and a great value in terms of credibility and trust and rule of law.
Result of a teamwork between any institution and also the family.
Fernando, perdón.
Yes.
Me, Fernando, excuse me. I wanted to just say something in terms from Ibrahim, in terms of the international community and the opportunity that the United Nations has upon this request in the report. The perspective has to be non-repetition. These mechanisms exist for non-repetition. This is a very important contribution for non-repetition. We cannot continue in our countries or in the world with any more disappearances. We have to work towards no more disappearances. And this is the usefulness of these mechanisms.
I mean, that point. I don't know if there is any question or any comment. I have more questions if somebody wants to make any intervention or questions. I don't know. Yes, sorry. Nicolas and Jael. I think that was the order. Nicolas. I think there is a mic coming here.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Fernando, for the excellent quality of the panel and discussion for the invitation. I represent Switzerland. Switzerland has supported the ESG report and we commend its conclusions. My question regards the fact that the government in Syria is unlikely to cooperate with the future mechanism, which is different from the situation in Colombia. What safety guarantees are foreseen for the people who will or live currently in Syria and will likely approach the mechanism in the future, knowing that, as been described before, when they seek for information, they are facing risks. So what difference does that make once the mechanism is in place for these people? What safety guarantees can we provide them with an international mechanism? Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a very good question about the security of the victims through the process when they are still ongoing violence and conflict. Amina, do you want anyone? Please can react, but Amina, if you want to take that question.
Thank you very much, Nicola. As a matter of fact, this is very much expected. What you have described is true. The Syrian government might not respond positively. And perhaps there might be a risk for those who are going to seek information. Let me be honest and frank. We as families, when we initiated this question of mechanism, We expected that, clearly, that the regime is not going to respond positively. It is not going to allow for this mechanism to enter Syria. Then what can we do in this situation? What I would like to say first, what's important for us is that this mechanism should be transferred from study to real fact. As for the regime to allow it to enter Syria or not, I would like to point out two things. We are trying hard to ask the supporting countries and that support the issues of human rights to have a pressure on other countries who are allied to the regime to allow this mechanism to take. This mechanism is clear. It has no political end. But, we are ready to listen to the viewpoints of our allies in the international community in this respect. This is the first point. But I'm sure that even if we have this pressure, the regime is not going to respond. Secondly, this mechanism is very important. At this point, the regime is not going to allow it. But perhaps this mechanism might not be reality until many years. Perhaps the political situation might change. In fact, the regime responds to the political situation in the world. Perhaps there will be other pressures that on the regime that would allow it to perhaps cooperate. Any political change would make this mechanism able to enter the country, but. This mechanism, if it cannot go to Syria, it doesn't mean that it's not going to function. No, this mechanism is very important for families to seek information about their relatives, their beloved ones. After the disappointment felt by Syrian families, perhaps they might have a resort to go to. I would like to add something else. It's very important, as was mentioned by Lola, the families, since we issued the study, it was us who issued the study. The associations of victims have started this study, and. Even the High Commission has been cooperating with us concerning this mechanism. Many years ago, the survivors and the family they go to the they speak before international fora as witnesses because they have no role in decision making. I don't like to be only a witness. I must have a role, not only participatory, but also leading role. This is what we want other families to have, a leading role. The word victims always refer to survivors. I know this is what we use usually. I don't consider myself victim. Out of my free will, I went to the street and I said no in Syria in demonstration. I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing now. It is conscientious resistance to a well-known dictatorship in my country, Syria.
Nicola, thank you for your question. And as I'll build on what Amina has said, everyone here knows that the regime, as the main perpetrator, doesn't have the word as to what's happening. Switzerland led a letter in 2014 with 65 member states to get a referral to the ICC that was double vetoed by Russia and China, by the protectors. The Security Council resolution, Russia's negotiating on behalf of the regime. Now, Russia denies the regime to engage in the political process in Switzerland for obvious reasons. So if the pressure mounts on the allies, things can and have moved in the past. Whenever there's enough international pressure on the allies, the Syrian regime and the non-state actors, neither of them have any control of what they do, where they fight, what in that sense. So that would be my first point. But you're absolutely right to worry about the lack of engagement. We've seen the reports say the ICRC doesn't have access, the ICMP doesn't have access, the IIIM doesn't have access, the Commission of Inquiry doesn't have access. The Working Group on Enforced Disappearance sent, I think, 22 communications out of 130,000, you can imagine the number. Four were responded to by the regime saying, I don't know where they are and what's happening. But regardless of that, and in addition to the benefits that Amina mentioned, I see a huge issue about Syria just slowly, because of the active disinformation tactics, becoming just a war zone where people disappear and all parties are trying to comply, but the environment doesn't work and there are challenges, which is not the case. It's not a war zone, it's a crime scene. And therefore, if the regime decides not to engage, then this should be known. And if allies try to, and other crimes try to disinform and protect, then this should be known. So for the truth and narrative perspective, a mechanism like this would hope, one of the hopes would be that other states that just see Syria as complex, oh, we don't know what to do, it's been going on for too long, we don't understand, would be able to actively counter the disinformation that is targeted towards these states and the states around, here with us today, by saying, no, we know exactly what happened, we know that this is a result of crimes, we know where these people are, and this party, or that, is refusing access. That is key, at least from a narrative perspective, even if we don't get the actual physical access.
Thank you very much, Ibrahim, the importance of that narrative and the search by a reparative justice measure. Luz Marina, how do you have handled this particular problem of the security of the families during the search?
Colombia is different, but in terms of security, not so different. In what sense? In that there's still armed conflict in Colombia, and that families continue to face safety and security challenges, and in many places where we carry out our searches are conflict zones where the humanitarian character itself in not being a non-judicial mechanism has enabled for these individuals to come in. But there's another element in the mechanism that is very valuable, which is confidentiality. Confidentiality not just for those who have engaged in the disappearances, but also for the family members themselves. To keep confidentiality about the fact that a family member is carrying out the search preserves the safety of the family members, and then we can also receive confidential information from family members. In carrying out this task as a duty by the states to carry out the search, and especially an international organization as the UN could do it under the Convention of Disappearance Persons, but also under the principles of reparation that address the right to know about the fate of the disappeared persons without exposing the family members. That would be important. And also, I believe that it will always be better facing a humanitarian right as a forced disappearance is to do something. I believe that one of these mechanisms will play a very important role. I think in order to preserve something that is very hard to achieve, which is preserve information. If information is not gathered timely, information gets lost. And that is why it is very important to act now.
Sebastian, Yael, please, do you have a mic? Yes.
I'm thinking that actually we are still, after World War II, finding disappeared people. We still have people meeting their family members. So perhaps we want to learn from history too. Also just to add to your, I'm very emotional, partly because your passion has come through so authentically. I take my hat off to all of you and to your bravery. Just to speak about the victim survivor, victims have rights in international law, survivors don't. So it's better to stick to the word victim when we talk about victims' rights. And that's, with all due respect to the feeling of being a survivor and a fighter, etc. With all of the, and victims' rights are extremely important here. Protection is a victim right. Participation is a victim right. Everything you want is already in international law, your right. Now, I want to just add something, Ibrahim, to your feeling that there is like a two different worlds between retributive justice and reparative justice. It's not, but what is needed for reparative justice is other disciplines, for example, mental health, psychological help, what you call humanitarian. There are whole disciplines that are actually devoted to this. And my question is, do you engage them too? I happen to be a psychologist, and this has been my life's work, to work with lawyers and with victims at the same time. The lawyers is more difficult.
I have something to say.
So I wanted to add that dimension too, and thank you. You revived my heart. And by the way, just to say the last thing, since I participated in creating all these resolutions, including the remedy resolution, the non-repetition is an expectation. Being of my age, I've heard so many never agains. And my heart has been broken so many times. So let's sort of stay on reality and keep demanding. But
yes. Understanding that this is a forever job, I believe. I'm gonna get one question back, and then I come back to the panel for collecting some thoughts on the psychosocial support and the mental health, which is very important.
Yeah,
but Priscilla.
Thanks so much, Fernando. I think this is on. I'm Priscilla Hainer. I'm a member of the UN standby team of senior mediation advisors. And I'm interested, I mean, listening to the discussion, I mean, despite the great difference between the two cases, as I agree has been pointed out, I'm increasingly persuaded of the importance that Luz Marina, as you have said, about collecting the information. And there's information that can be collected and organized and researched into, despite the fact of, you know, challenges with access, for example, or lack of government cooperation, perhaps. But I wanted to ask another question, and particularly ask the perspective from Colombia. I noticed in the Secretary General's report, one of the recommendations was that if there were to be a special mechanism, that could also create a trust fund for victims and family members. And to me, that raises both opportunities and challenges, that idea. Because if you link specifically the trust fund together with the search for the missing, then that seems to potentially present complications in terms of having a global reparations strategy, for example, complicating the search process with a reparations program. But at the same time, the victims and the family members are very much due some sort of support when it is known and identified when persons have been disappeared. I'm curious how Colombia would see that question. I know there's a separate reparations initiative in Colombia, but was that also discussed to link it more closely, or do you all link your findings together with the reparations plan in Colombia? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Priscilla, for your intervention. I'm just going to ask, we address first the psychosocial support and the mental health, and then, Luz Marina, you can address that question directly. Gloria, do you want to say something about the psychosocial support, and then Amina Ibrahim, if you want, si quieres. No pressure.
Bueno, la verdad es que mi organización, ASFAES,
my organization, as FARES, facing the lack of interest when 40 years ago we ourselves were not aware of the emotional damage, especially not knowing that there was need because we did not believe in psychologists. So it's been quite a process. There are laws in Colombia that talk about the psychosocial aspects of supporting the family in this situation, of the emotional impact. But we particularly believe that from institutionality, there's a lot that needs to be done. Because to provide the right support to a family member of a disappeared person requires a professional that can take into account the focus that Luz Marina was mentioning, not just ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, political convictions. So there's a very complex impact that we face. I believe that the psychosocial aspect is very important for as long as these professionals or disciplines are adequate to be able to support the impact or address the impact. And I believe that a very timely proposal is the role of academia in terms of professional psychologists. But I believe that even though certain development has been achieved in Colombia and including certain aspects of the reality of the family of disappeared persons, but academia plays a very important role for these professionals to be able to provide the support to the family to transition not just the pain, the hope or hopelessness, the anger, the lack of hope that disappearance generates, the expectations, because every single day there's a different emotion and a different feeling that is endless and that it does not give the result that we expect, which is to receive news about our family members. And when I say family members, we're talking about all disappeared persons, because it is true that come in because of your individual case, but then the damage is a collective one, and so the fight is collective. So I believe that psychosocial support is very important. We ourselves have our own model based on the reality of our suffering. I believe that as FARES has, in fact, taken this on, we have addressed academia in terms of the fact that psychosocial support must stem from a therapeutic, which we call living and healing memory. We can say that over the last 40 years, this has enabled us to become women that have been resilient, facing the lack of memory or forgetting the victims by society. Because, see, for us, the psychosocial aspect is collective, because we are in fighting for them is a therapeutic exercise.
The first thing when I left my prison, I was looking for psychologists. This was very important. It was very important to visit a psychologist. At least we can face something about the former shocks. I'm not going to talk about the details of prison in Syria. Prisons were like graves underground. I need a psychologist. And I always saw a therapist, a psychologist. This was very important. When established Women for Freedom, the first thing I noticed that there was a team of protection for families so that these families can consult a psychologist so that they can seek help, they can talk about what they feel. This was very important indeed. It is very important that Secretary General's report referred to this issue in the second part of the mandate of mechanism. I would like to be faithful to you. Today, I received a very important dose of trust and confidence. You can't imagine. My mixed feelings. I have not met her before. She is from a different continent. However, we are united by one continent, the continent of pain, the continent of hope. I a few years ago, I talked to Kutaiba. I said, I'm going to resign from all works in public affairs. But when I heard from her that she has been struggling for 40 years, then something inside me happened. But there's something painful. Are we going to continue 30 years ahead, we Syrians? What I won't say. Meeting with her, in fact, living the same condition is a kind of psychological support, at least for me. This is more important than visiting a psychologist. With all respect to psychologists here.
So I realize lawyers are difficult in many ways, and so I institutionalized psychological support by marrying a psychologist. Right? I don't know, I'm not sure she knew what she was getting into, but let's keep that for another day. In all honesty, I, as a lawyer, when I listen and take witness statements from torture survivors, I can no longer do it. I let my other colleagues who have never been experienced, who cannot relate, do it on my behalf, because I just can't. It's an impossible situation for me to relive and rehear those stories over and over that I can relate to. And so, to add to what Amina has said, the way we're able, at least for me personally, to continue after 10 years, and able is the wrong word, because in a lot of mornings I'm unable. And I speak for many of the Syrians here around the room by saying the same thing. But you're also unable to quit. So you're unable to push, but you're also unable to quit. We were just discussing that we've never seen anything out of New York City other than the UN and the hotels, just because we feel guilty for going out and exploring something because we're here on a mission, something that's unhealthy. And so for me, the way I am able to continue, in addition to hearing the stories of Gloria and others who do fantastic work, is seeing this room filled today. And I mean it. I work with policymakers, which need a psychologist on their own, right? So like for me to engage with diplomats who say, can you put this in a memo and send me something in writing, and we'll pass it on and we'll get back to you, is its own trauma. But in a way, seeing people sitting in a room 10 years on from Syria discussing what can they still do is motivating. It gives me hope. It gives me that there are people who know the feeling, ambassadors who live in New York, who feel the pain of people like Amna across the Atlantic, across the world. That in itself is something that allowed me to come here, although I'm spending 18 hours in New York and just heading back, to be able to come and speak. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Ibrahim. Does Marina, final comment.
Bueno, voy a tratar de responder.
I'm going to try to answer Priscilla. It's a very timely question and very important, because, and I can see it with the implementation of the mandate. In Colombia, there is a division, the division of reparation in terms of restitution and also caring for other needs. That is the responsibility of another institution and another policy, not necessarily with the peace deal. The UNITY has an important task, which is to search for the disappeared persons, but it says that you need to do it with the involvement of relatives. For a family member to truly participate, must have all their needs resolved, or at least the most pressing ones. And that's what a reparation policy should have. For instance, children's education, housing, for instance, to be able to go to a meeting, work, the work situation, to have resources that will allow the person to resolve the most important needs of the family in order to attend a meeting, to collect information, to document, to go to demonstrations, to make claims. You don't have these needs met. The true opportunities of involvement are very limited. Therefore, I do believe that, just like the report says, it needs to be comprehensive. It needs to have a comprehensive approach, keeping in mind that the search include a lot of technical activities, of information, of approaches, but there is a human dimension that require all these reparation activities in order to guarantee reparation. And finally, I would say search should not be... I always feel that search is not interpreted as a reparation measure. And based on the principles of the UN, the search is a reparation measure. Therefore, it needs to be interpreted in that way. I would say, like, the victims of serious violations of human rights are entitled to be repaired, offering information, among others, of the disappearance of their loved ones. We have seen here that a report says that the search needs to do with support of the families. And the report talks about this comprehensive approach. I believe that these two elements need to be together and not in opposition, to offer true guarantees of involvement and reparation.
I'm going to ask you for 7 more minutes of your time. We are not going to have closing remarks, but we want to show you some closing remarks that we've prepared for you. And it's so powerful, everything what we've heard here, and it's so meaningful and motivating also for us to have you here, and so important, that we want to create a moment of reflection, a very, you know, moment of reflection. I'm going to ask you to turn to see the screen, and everybody, you don't need your headsets anymore, so we're going to watch something. Do you want to introduce while they get ready the film? Yes.
We need to change our...
Hello. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, Amina, Gloria, Rahim, Luz, for this incredible discussion. My name is Lucia Kavuat, and I have the honor and pleasure of leading ICTJ's work on Syria. And I'm working with my amazing colleagues, Kutaiba and Elena and Fernando and everyone else here. Thank you. This film is based on true stories. We worked for several years, as Fernando said, with 8 Syrian civil society organizations. And the report that's in front of you has the stories of family members inside Syria and in Turkey. And this film is a compilation of those stories. As Ibrahim and Amina and Gloria, this is their story. This tells the story of family members who remain in limbo, wondering if they should continue the search, if they should continue with their lives, or what they should do. So this is the first time we're screening in front of an audience, so please enjoy, and thank you.
Thank you. ماما ماما
جئتي لبابا؟
لا لسه حبيباتي، بس بكرة بكمل.
Thank you very much, everybody, for being with us today. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed Amina, Ibrahim, Luz Marina, Gloria. Thank you very much. I would ask an applause for all of them. Thank you.